Welcome to the Deeks.ai podcast, where Wake Forest innovators unpack the real-world magic of artificial intelligence through candid conversations. I'm Michael Ferrari.
I'm Ryan Scholl.
Please join us as we explore how artificial intelligence is transforming work across campus, one fascinating story at a time. Get ready to discover the human side of technological innovation. On this episode, we are joined by Kevin Frazier, Associate Professor of Design and Production at Wake Forest University. Please join us as we speak with Kevin about going from an artificial intelligence skeptic to a borderline evangelist. Kevin discusses his journey with AI, its use in the classroom, how students approach AI, and some of the red flags that still exist, even to those like Kevin who find themselves embracing AI despite the uncertain future it's bringing with it.
Okay, well, Kevin, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you so much.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll get into your AI usage.
Absolutely. So I am an associate professor in the Department of Theater and Dance. Before I went into academia, I was a full-time freelance artist, so designing lights, sound, digital media for theatrical events across the country. And I started... Mentorship is kind of always a part of collaborative art, that you're always sort of in conversation with folks who are at different points of their journey. I found that I really started to take a shine to helping people find their way into our business, started teaching part-time, got really excited about teaching, and then I came to Wake in 2016.
Good that you got excited about teaching.
Yeah. Well, and ultimately, too, it became about like, it was really hard for me figuring out kind of where the door was, how to open the door and how to get through the door. So I started to feel called to, like, how can I hold the door open for the next folks? And so that's a kind of foundational part of my teaching. So I went from being a full-time freelance artist and a part-time educator to just doing the reverse. So my sort of scholarship with the university is entirely derived from my creative work. So I still travel and do freelance professional design work.
So you're out there practicing what you preach.
Yes, because I think that it's essential, especially in the arts, to have a finger on the pulse of what's happening creatively and sort of functionally in the business, so that when we're in the classroom talking to our students about it, it's not just this is the sort of intellectual and emotional imprint of what I experienced 10 years ago. It's no, this is something that happened to me last week, or this is something that's going to happen to me next week. To start the AI thing, although I'm sure you'll have a really sweet guiding question, but when I teach it in my classes, a lot of what I'm showing them is stuff that I've used in professional work, like either as a research method or a collaborative tool or in the generation of digital media, or like the ways in which I use it are also like reflected in the classroom, that it's like, how can I take my own lived experience with these tools, share that with our students? So it's all like, that's one of the reasons I still work professionally with some regularity, is that it also gives me a chance to explore new technologies and new tools so that I can bring them to our students.
So where some people may see a wall between technology and the arts, you're basically shattering that wall and combining those two disciplines.
Well, especially because my three sort of primary areas of design, lighting, sound, and projections, digital media, they all require a synthesis of sort of engaged storytelling, but also technological know-how, right? Like you have to understand how a sound system is balanced and engineered in order to play sounds through it. You need to understand how electricity works and how to program a computer console in order to make your lighting design come to life. You need to understand how to manipulate, edit, and generate digital content, and how projectors work, and how the systems that you build with computers and projectors, like you need to know how all of that works in order to execute your vision. So it's funny for me because I came into it really from a more esoteric, like, story-centered, art-centered perspective, but I discovered quickly that understanding technology was a critical component of doing this work well. And so in a lot of ways, I'm always like just running slightly behind the technology, but the longer I'm in it, the more I'm realizing in some ways I'm miles ahead of some of my peers, mm-hmm. like just in the technology.
Yeah.
And you don't have to know how to do it at an expert level to do, to tell great stories,
yep.
but it helps you tell them more efficiently.
Storytelling is so powerful. Mm. Well, it's such an underrated skill that people don't realize how effective a good story can be.
And in a lot of ways, that's one of the, that's really at the center of my own journey using AI, that I would say about 2 or 3 years ago, a very dear friend of mine, Will Lowry, who teaches at Lehigh University, got really interested in AI. And a lot of the early conversations we had on the subject, I had adopted a very sort of reactionary, anxious response. Like, hold on a minute, this feels ethically murky. This feels problematic.
Nobody knew about it. Nobody really understood it beyond like the research labs and the people who had done it.
Right. Before. And so spending time with him and him showing me the work he was doing in it encouraged me to kind of give it a shot. And the vast majority of my early work with AI tools, and still is today, was through Midjourney because of its Discord functionality. Yeah. So like,
and Midjourney
is one of the generative AI platforms. So like it was
for images.
It's like, and when I started using Midjourney, there weren't other, like DALL-E existed and I think Stable Diffusion existed, but like there weren't, like these days you can jump into ChatGPT and Bing, and like there are multiple things that are going to generate images. Midjourney is where I started, and it's still where I do the majority of my generations, in part too because as a pedagogical tool, if you're teaching Midjourney in a class, now, when I do that, we'll build a class Discord server, invite the Midjourney bot into it, and then the students can see each other's generations.
Yeah, that's really cool.
The sort of challenge there is that it becomes a materials cost for the student because there is no longer any sort of meaningful trial version. So they do have to pay. It's like $10 a month for the base level subscription. I think I pay $30 because I just want to be able to, like, when I am in a season, when I'm doing a lot of generations, I'm doing like 100 or 200 in a sitting. So it's like, I want to be able to do that quickly. And the more you pay, the sort of more processing power it allows you to use repeatedly over the course of a month. So
let's stick on this thread for a little while. I want to talk about Midjourney. So that's the one you're most comfortable with.
Yes.
Have you used some of the other image generation?
I've played with them. So like, in as far as I have seen them prompted into them and seen the result, yes. Mm-hmm. Although actually the most time I've spent in particular with DALL-E and Stable Diffusion is a website, a tool that I want to call attention to called the Diffusion Bias Explorer. Okay. The function of it is that you, at least in its original form, was you choose an adjective and you choose a career, and it will show you what DALL-E and Stable Diffusion versions 1 and 2 will show you. Like it'll generate the images based on that adjective and that profession. Mm-hmm. The reason that has been really helpful for me in classrooms is because foundational to my approach around generative image work is that it goes back to that question of story, right? Like the AI models only know what they've been given, and they're at the mercy of the people who are feeding that information into them. So the Diffusion Bias Explorer will show you like, oh, apparently to it, every frustrated teacher is a young woman. Every ambitious doctor is a person of color of a particular ethnicity or point of origin, right? That like, so all of our human sort of orientations to life and experience, all of our sort of sometimes reductive, like the shortcuts that we make in our brains about people and things, like AI models are kind of—
because that's the data it's trained on.
Yes. So they're taking that with them. So for me, it's really about in the classroom, like the sort of snappy phrase I use is that AI is a springboard for creativity. It's not its replacement, right? That because understanding what its ethical boundaries are, understanding what its limitations are, is, I think, central to teaching effective AI literacy, right? Like you need to understand, A, that it's not making something, it's reacting to your suggestion. I mean, it is technically making something, but like what it's doing is trying to satisfy a text line.
Mm-hmm.
I have some friends who were kind of earlier in their journeys with image generators, and they'll say, it didn't give me what I wanted. And I always respond like, that's the point. Yeah. It's never going to give you what you want, but it will always give you something that makes you think. Yeah. And, you know, like the more esoteric kind of perspective on this for me is like, you know, AI doesn't have a soul. It doesn't have the like...
Don't let it hear you say that.
I know. It was like, I so in classrooms, I'm like, AI doesn't have a soul, .. Well, it's funny too, because like science fiction storytelling has been playing in that sandbox for decades, right? Like, but to me, it's like, I can look at an image that's generated in Bing, DALL-E, Midjourney, but it takes my observation of it to impugn it with meaning.
Yeah.
It takes my engagement with it for it to take on life. And I think that a lot of our students are kind of stumbling into these tools as shortcuts, as bypasses. And so I like to spend a lot of time in my courses saying, no, I'm not afraid of it. I actually think it's an incredible tool. I use it a lot in, I'll go into Midjourney and I'll really focus on research around abstraction. Like I wanna give voice to ideas or emotions that are running through my mind in the context of a script or a story. And then I wanna go to my director or my other collaborators and say, well, here are some images. You'll notice that this part is just not useful at all, but this thing over here is really interesting to me. Or the way that my words were interpolated in through this program created something that I think we might be able to use, not in a literal way, but in a conversational way. Again, springboard. That's a big part of it for me, is that it's a springboard to creativity, right? Like it opens doors. It is not a door itself.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes we get kind of that gets lost in the middle sometimes. But my focus on its sort of ethical boundaries, and I mean, it's the joke I often say is like, if you're going to cheat, I want you to cheat so well that you realize that you should have just done the work in the first place, because cheating effectively takes so much time. Well, it's like, you know, the person who tries to write an essay using ChatGPT. Well, I got to tell you, like, it's not even just that it uses language in a peculiar way. It's also just that even if it feels like it has depth, it's most often artificial depth, yeah. Right? Yeah. I find the same thing in image generators, that like the work I have to do to get it to create something in really evocative and exciting, like nobody sees that part. Like nobody sees my history where it's like, here were the 20 generations I did and the three rounds of variations on this one, and then I varied by region, and then I did this, and then I did that, to get it to do the thing that most closely approximated the conversational point I wanted to broach with it. Like, it just, you look at it, you're like, oh, look at how quickly it made that image. Yeah. Look at how quickly it generated that text.
What's really interesting about what you're saying is you're focusing on Midjourney, and this parallels what most people understand about LLMs, right? You know, ChatGPT, Gemini, Claude, we always say, especially for the people jumping in, pick a tool that you're familiar with, get to know it, stick with it, because most of these tools are going to do about 85-90% of what you took. But you talk about all the steps you've gone through with, you know, with Midjourney. You are understanding how you can use Midjourney, what prompts you have to give it to get what you want. You could go use Stable Diffusion, Flux, Imagen 3, DALL-E. Yeah, it can produce very similar results, but you're comfortable with Midjourney. So I think that's an important point for people to understand, that there's so many tools out there. Most likely, stick with one, learn it, get good at it. Because if you keep switching back and forth,
it's weird too, because like it's kind of hard to explain in some ways, but it's like if you took some of your earliest generations and compared it to like one you made today, you would be able to tell, like, I don't know if skill's the right word or what, but
it's like, how effective am I at communicating with the program?
Yeah. And you understand Midjourney, you understand the results you're going to get by this prompt.
Right.
You know, I've been playing around with Imagen 3 in Google AI Studio. I'm getting good at that. I like that. If I went over to Midjourney, it would take me a lot longer.
And Midjourney too, like one of the things I like about Midjourney, and I don't know if this is true for the other image models, is that you can ask it to feed your prompt through previous iterations of the algorithm. So like I can put in a prompt and say, --v2,
yep.
and it will send it through the version 2 algorithm. Cool. So you can actually see how it's developed in its understanding of your prompts and your understanding of your language.
Do you know if it's a, I don't know Midjourney that well, do you know if it's a transformer or a diffusion model?
I don't know off the top of my head. But I would highly like, if you have it, if you already have a Discord account, highly recommend invite it. Like you can even, you can join the Midjourney server and they're constantly giving information about updates and tools. Cause that's the other thing that, to your point, a lot of these models have so many sort of tricks of computer programming mm-hmm. that they're because they started in coding spaces. A lot of like Midjourney feels like it reminds me of when I was doing C++ in high school, right? It's like, it's not the same thing, but it's the same kind of like, oh, you have to put this command here and do this here. And it cares a lot about parentheses, quotation marks, okay. you know, like where things are, because that's the language it's speaking, right?
So if you're understanding this, how do your students come in? And what is your students' familiarity with Midjourney coming into a class?
A lot of, so it's funny, right? Because like 2 or 3 years ago, it wasn't so, the market wasn't so diffuse. Like there was Midjourney and DALL-E and yeah. like a few of the other ones were coming up. ChatGPT was really the only effective like LLM that like,
yeah.
and now like it, because things are moving so quickly, like now it's like anybody can do it. Like yeah. as recently as 2 years ago, the first time I taught Midjourney in a course, it was like, well, this is kind of the one. But by now I'm teaching intro to theater and they're doing it in Bing, they're doing it in Google, they're you know. So in some ways, I don't think that it like I'm actually thinking about next year proposing like crafting an FYS proposal for a first year seminar on AI and creativity so that I can just spend a semester diving into this stuff because yeah. right now I've been kind of superimposing it onto my existing courses. But yeah, I think that there are better on-ramps now for image generation than there were when I was learning it even 3 years ago.
So the students come in being a little more familiar.
Yes. So like when I used Midjourney in my lighting design class 2 years ago, like we had a series of assignments that were like, you know, you're just going to use the imagine command and make an image and see what you get. And just, we just sort of started at the bottom and scaffolded our way up.
And what are they making images for?
So at the beginning, the original assignment prompts were like, just type in a word, just so you see what happens. Then I was like, okay, type in an emotional qualifier, see what you get. Then it's type in a movement in art history, see what you get. I'm so sorry to my art history friends listening to this. but then it was like, you know, how do we like, so that they could learn how dramatically qualifiers impacted their result. And then it eventually became, I also said, one of the assignments was, highlight an era in film, like use that as your qualifier, you know, like how do you, that also too, to be effective at the image generators, you have to also have a high level of media literacy. You have to have a high level of cultural literacy to actually be an effective user of these things, right? To the point where on most of my exams now, no matter what class I'm teaching, because AI is at least a sizable, usually spend like 2 to 4 class days in most of my classes exploring it. One of my questions is usually like, you know, how do you see AI intersecting with what's happening here? And so that some of our students have an intensely utopian vision of what AI is going to do. That does not assume ill intent. And I think that a lot of nerves around AI are because folks assume ill intent. And I think for me, the truth has been kind of in the middle, right? Like, yeah, when I...
And this generation has come up with technology...
in a completely different way than we did.
Where the professors, you know, a lot of them, when they came up in their adolescence, technology was not as big, so... There is that kind of butting heads a little bit.
Well, I'm in that last generation of didn't have the stuff. It happened in my lifetime,
same.
Right?
Like, yeah, same.
So it's like our perspective is sort of the most liminal. It's like we're able to pick it up with some ease, but like I understand how life functions without it.
Yeah.
And I understand what's beautiful about life when those are not part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, I have some students who are like, AI is going to help us rehearse plays. It's going to do all this work. And it's like, well, hold on a minute. And then I have some students who are already noticing like, yeah, but I don't think that it should take opportunities and jobs away from people. And it's like that tension, because you hear about it in the strikes, in the video game industry, like in industries where crunch is a substantial part of the work culture, where result is a really, like, result and speed. You know, it's in theater, we talk about the sort of triangle of values. It's good, fast, and cheap. You can have two, but you can't have all three. Mm-hmm. Yep. And at video games, it's the same sort of thing. And it's like, well, no, I want good and fast. So I'm going to use maybe AI as a shortcut to that. And then you get the beginning of this calendar year, Activision got a lot of flack because in Call of Duty, the new Black Ops game, there's an AI-generated image of a Santa, zombie Santa, as like a loading screen. And if you look, he sure has six fingers. Going back to that ethical boundary thing, it's like it doesn't know what the anatomy is.
Yeah.
It just knows something's sticking out, right? Like it knows that that's a line that goes out there usually. So like
what blows my mind is AI is passing all these Turing tests and humanity's last exam and it's scoring better than humans on this, but it still puts six fingers.
Yeah, like that's the number.
Blows my mind.
My number one AI test is like, can you spot the monster person?
Yeah.
Like as soon as you ask it to do people, it's making a monster man. Oh, yeah. Like somewhere in that image is a monster man. I promise you.
Yeah. Try to get it to produce the Wake Forest Demon Deacon.
Try. No, I quit. I'm not trying ever again.
Because the thing is, because again, it takes each word at complete face value.
Yeah.
It's not capable of putting those things in conversation with each other. It's simply saying demon, deacon. So what is a deacon if it looks like a demon?
Yeah.
So you just get like
one of my colleagues,
devil
poke. Yeah, you just produced an image. And it was Wake Forest Demon Deacon, and it kind of had some elements, but it took forest. So put it in a forest,
yeah.
And it was like a werewolf.
Yep. And you'd be better off saying angry old white man with top hat.
Yeah, Victorian. I've learned Victorian.
Yeah, this angry old Victorian white man top hat. Like you just have to give. You have to give it every. Although, again, speaking about ethical boundaries. If you just said angry old man in a top hat Victorian, it would just give you a white man anyway, right?
So I want to touch on the ethical thing specifically because of what you do and your and what you said before about your art history friends. I'm sure
yeah.
You have a ton of friends who are, you know, into art in a variety of ways. Have you gotten any big pushback from them?
I think generally no, because the way I'm using it is not in any meaningful way to pass off as something I did.
Okay.
Right? It's an exploration I had. It's not a product I made.
Okay.
Right? And I think that strikes back at the same question of like, is AI, is it part of your process or is it your product?
Okay.
Right? And in the Call of Duty example with Six Finger Santa, it's like that became the product,
yeah,
not the process. And I think for me, that distinction is really important.
And I really like that. I really like product versus process.
Yeah. Mm. It's like AI is absolute part of my process.
Yeah.
Even if I'm using it in projected content, it's always layered, manipulated. I go into Photoshop, I go into QLab, which is our playback program, and I manipulate it with filters and effects, and I'm collaging it with other media that I've sourced. And so it's like, it's never just the thing that you see. Right. And I'm never saying that it's my, like, because design is ultimately curation. Theatrical design is an act of curation. It's I'm gathering disparate things and combining them to make something new. So to me, image generation is just a part of that toolkit. In terms of a language model, like, I spend a lot of time on that in my intro to theater class because I want them to, again, understand that it understands. It's like if you trained the dictionary to talk to you, right? Like it's going to give you something that's factually accurate, but it doesn't have any nuance. It doesn't have any heart, right? So the project that they're going to be presenting on Friday actually is we've had them take the balcony scene from Romeo and Juliet, Act 2, Scene 2, and to take a conceptual framework. So like Wild West or McCarthy, the McCarthy era, or and they have to write a short scene using only ChatGPT that melds those two things together.
Oh, wow.
And the other part of the prompt was you cannot rewrite it. You have to reprompt it through the program. So I've already had a few students say, like, it took me 10 tries just to get a play that didn't sound like garbage.
Do you have them show you their prompts?
I don't, but I probably should. But yeah, no, I mean, it's like, but you can tell, like, you can, because I also did the exercise in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I asked ChatGPT, I said, write a play about people writing a play using ChatGPT.
Mm.
And it wrote a short play. And then I said, write act two of this play. And it kept getting more bonkers. And then act three, like, everyone was ChatGPT and ChatGPT was everyone. And I think the last thing ChatGPT said was, like, the story goes on endless for infinity. And it's like, again, it's not that it's non-functional, right? Yeah, it's like, oh, if my Encyclopedia Britannica could talk to me when I asked it a question, this is what it would do. It would give me something that clears all of the benchmarks, but does nothing more or less. And I think I haven't spent as much time in it because I'm more interested in imagery, right? Like that's something I use both in terms of generating content for the collaging I do in digital media, both for having conversations with directors and other collaborators, but also too, I'm really deliberate. I don't use it to do. So in our design classes, we talk about denotative research and connotative research. Denotative being sort of literal, historical, like if a play is set in a 1950s courtroom, the denotative space is, well, what did the interior of courtrooms in the geographical region you're doing, like, what did that look like?
Mm-hmm.
Connotative is more what I've been talking about. Like, how does it make you feel? What are the sort of psychological or emotional landscapes that we're exploring? What image generators do brilliantly is this thing. What they do to make monster people is this thing, right? It's like, if I'm asking it, like, because you can ask it to design a set for a play, mm-hmm. but it doesn't understand, like, it knows what a set is and it knows what a play is, but it doesn't know any of the principles of design and composition. It just knows what it has and says, oh, I think this is what you mean. Because all it's trying to do is satisfy you.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing too, right? Is it's like, that's why the product part feels so appealing, because it's trying to satisfy you. It wants to give you what you want.
Yeah.
But process is where the actual work happens. Like, that's where the actual creativity happens. That's where the intellectual stimulation happens.
Yeah.
So yeah, it tricks you. Like, I look at an image and I'm like, oh yeah. But if I ask it to design a set, it's more so that I can say, oh, this piece here is actually pretty interesting. How might that resolve in other work I'm doing? Or, oh, it's really interesting how it's using space here. That's wildly unrealistic and unachievable. But is there something in that that might spur something in our process?
Yeah.
So let me ask you.
Yeah.
I'm gonna play contrarian here for a second.
Go for it.
You said process is where the intellectual stimulation is happening, but then you're also saying use these generative AI tools to help with the process.
Yes.
So could that potentially mean the student is losing some of that ability in that process?
Really? Well, I see what you're saying. That's tasty. Probably don't leave that in the edit. But it is. Like, there's some real meat to that question, right? It's like, and I haven't really... I think this is part of the reason why I want to spend a whole semester on it,
mm-hmm.
is because I don't think I have the time and space to get to that answer, because it's been on my mind. Mm-hmm. Like, I want them to know how to use it. I want them to understand its capabilities and limitations. I want them to at least have a cursory understanding mm-hmm. of the sort of ethical implications of what they're doing. And I want them to understand that it's a springboard, not a result, but also, like, you really need more time for them to build those muscles and to sort of learn those behaviors. Because yeah, like, if you do it too quickly, maybe they'll just, like, they'll understand all the stuff I just said, but then they'll still wield it as a replacement for their process, not as an augmentation to their process.
Which is interesting, because we are in an academic environment. You know, in theory, students come here to learn. They come here to expand their minds, learn new skills and tools. Where if you're in the real world, yes, sometimes you want to produce the product. You know, that's the end goal. But the learning journey here, that is the product for the students.
Yes.
So I can see where people are really struggling with the process versus the product.
There's an inherent tension there, right?
And that's the disheartening thing about the Call of Duty example he used, is because there's countless people now, more than ever, going to school for game design and all that. And then they see, all right, so I put in all this work, maybe since I was a kid, and then they put in this prompt and you get it, you know, you get that just generated for you. So,
yeah. And so it's like, I think that we're also in this interesting transitory space as educators, right? That we want to prepare people to enter the industries with strong AI literacy and sort of ethics, so that they can.
We want to prepare them for the real world.
Yeah, and we want to prepare them to be good stewards of that technology. But I think in higher ed right now, we're still in this sort of reactionary space. And I find myself like, I didn't expect to accidentally be on the vanguard because I was there too, like 3 years ago. And I've really come to admire and love and be really fascinated by it all. But I think that I feel like my charge and responsibility as an educator is to have that conversation to say, you know, I'm not saying don't use it. I'm saying use it, but understand why you're using it and understand how you're using it. And I think, again, I've just been over the last year and a half, I've been like, God, I really just need to like, I just need to spend a whole semester on this with somebody just so that it's not an ancillary component of an existing course structure, that it's, no, we're going to really dive into, I want you to understand how it fits into your own process so that when you get out into an industry where it's being used, you're using it as part of your process to get to your product faster, not I'm using it to make a product without thinking about it, or I'm shortcutting my own creative or intellectual process by using this instead, right? It's like, how do you get that synthesis? That's tough.
Have you had any students by any chance that were really against it?
No. Like, I mean, here's the funny thing, right? Like last spring when I taught Intro to Theater and I said, okay, we're going to, you know, we were talking about a particular type of global theater. And I said, well, let's have ChatGPT sort of write a play in that style so that we can pick apart, like, what are the things it's getting right and what are the things it's doing poorly? Like every student in my class had an account. This semester, teaching the same class, I had like 5 or 6 students who had never used the program in their lives. So it comes and goes, right? Like, I think last year was, it's like, that was ChatGPT's kind of it moment, right? But also too, lest we forget, at least one version of that model knew nothing that happened after 2021, right? Or 2022, I forget what the cutoff was, but like, you know, and they also will mistake things that it does as sort of signposts that it is better than it is. Like sometimes ChatGPT gets a little catty. I don't know if you've had that experience, but like in talking about like writing reviews for productions they see, you know, I showed them like, here's what, you know, I'm gonna attempt to make it write a review for a play I never saw. And it will talk in really well-phrased platitudes, but we did Witness for the Prosecution last year. It's the famous Agatha Christie mystery. And I asked ChatGPT to tell me how the play ended. And it said, well, I think you got to see it for yourself. I was like, all right. But like, that does, like, that's not, like, that's the cattiness of whoever fed it.
Oh, yeah.
That's not its own cattiness, right?
Well, that, you know, one thought there is, if you're asking it to give a review, it would help to give it a persona. You know, are you a first-time playgoer, or are you a reviewer for, you know, I don't know, whatever, a famous review?
Yeah. Well, and that too, like, that's a great point as well, because going back to image generation, that's the whole thing. I mean, I talked about a lot of the assignments I gave were about understanding qualifiers, right? Like putting things in context is already important in our lives. Like it's important to center something in time, in place, in like, there's so many, I mean, as actors, our students and professionals are constantly sort of answering questions or providing texture for a thing that maybe the script doesn't give you, but that you need to embody the person you're playing. In AI generation, you also have to provide that context. Otherwise, it's just going to say, demon, deacon, behold, Satan Pope. It's like, well, that's not really what I was doing. Like,
yeah, so I'm going to try that next time. Maybe I'll get a better response. Yeah. Satan Pope.
Satan Pope, but to see what you get. Well, again, it's like, because nothing is as simple as the piece of information that's there, right? Like an object is more than its components, which seems obvious, but like it's not to some of our AI models, right? It's just looking at the words. Maybe it cares about the order in which you put them. Sometimes it definitely doesn't. It will just sort of say, oh, you said forest. Perhaps you meant in the forest. And you're like, well, I didn't, but okay. And when you tell it no, sometimes that makes it double down, which I think is funny.
Yep.
Like, I don't want any of this. And they're like, oh, you wanted more of those. I see.
So you started on the other side, you said, a few years ago, and then kind of embraced it and surprisingly found yourself here. Now, if it started closing that gap of, you know, the just the lack of context and lack of feeling human and all that, do you think you could see yourself going back to where you started?
I don't think so. I think that, at this point, the toothpaste is out of the tube. Okay. And I think that in the same way that at the beginning of this, I said, working in the industry is important to my pedagogy. I think also understanding where these tools are is important to my teaching.
Okay.
You know, like, and also too, I, even if, cause I think we've sort of started to hit some of the first ceilings, I think, in these models, right? Like they're not getting that much better than they were a year ago. Or at least in my experience, it's not like the first couple of years, the leaps, right? Like everything was happening so fast. It seemed scary. Well, now it's been happening a little more slowly. It's in fact, instead of this, it's this.
Well, speaking of gaming, like you did before, it reminds me, it's like you go from like a Nintendo to a PlayStation. It's like, and then now the new PlayStation, it's not even close to as big of a jump from the last.
Yeah, it goes from exponential to granular, yeah. Right? That like, and I feel like that's been happening in the AI models. It went from exponential growth to just sort of granular adjustment. Instead of vertical growth, now it's lateral growth. More people are building models. They're chasing each other to sort of have the most efficient or effective model. But its capacity, at least in this moment, feels like we've hit a bit of a peak. Yeah. But even if that changed, I still think that it's my responsibility as an educator to understand the tools, even if I don't embrace them. I mean, I have, but yeah. Even if I didn't embrace them, I still think I have to understand them. Because how am I going to be
incredibly important?
Yeah,
like, in the underlying
and be able
data, or
yeah, and to be able to have those conversations with the students, right? It's like I can't have that conversation with them if I'm not using it and understanding how I interact with it. Again, it goes back to context, right? Like my relationship to those tools better equips me to have a conversation, even if I don't know all the idiosyncrasies of those tools. It gives me enough fluency and literacy to say, no, I'm not just having a reaction based on sort of unearned expertise. I'm having a reaction based on my own lived experience. And I want you as a student to do the same.
So be able to recognize it too.
Yeah.
You know, because if you work with a language model for even a little bit, and suddenly it's like, oh yeah, now if someone turns in an essay, you know, you could like,
yeah.
Again, it's like, you could definitely tell. It's like, it's essay by Mad Libs, right? You're like, ah, okay. I think I've seen this one before. I mean, like, to the point too, where it will, like, its vocabulary is not my vocabulary. So that's become a real quick way to identify. Mm-hmm. Like, if it's talking about something that maybe I've talked about, but if it's describing it in a way that I didn't, that's pretty obvious. Like, and it's also too, like, it's hard to get it to do the language ones in particular. It's really hard to get it to do something long. Mm-hmm. Like, I have found that it takes real work to make it do something in terms of playwriting in particular. Okay. It takes a lot of effort to get it to do something more than 2 pages long. And in terms of essays, my understanding is that it can just go to town, but like, I don't know if it can write a 20-page paper, or if it does, how long does it take to get it to actually write a 20-page paper that you could like look yourself in the mirror and say you turned in? Hey, like, and again, it goes back to one of my earlier points. It's like, I want students to figure out, oh, I might as well have just, like, what can ChatGPT do? It can maybe clean up some of your phrasing. It can clean up your language. It can help you clarify a point, right? Again, springboard, not replacement. Like, how can a thing improve and augment? I mean, again, it goes back to the dystopian sci-fi thing, right? It's like, you know, at what point does augmentation compromise your soul? At what point does augmentation replace living? At what point does, you know, we've been sort of storytellers have been asking these questions for a long time. It's just now those questions have broached into sort of corporate culture and corporate mainstream culture, right? Like, oh, like, and also too, it, you know, it paints, it sometimes paints a frustrating picture of, well, we want people to enter these industries, but then we do things that show that we don't particularly care if they enter these industries. And that's tough. And like, I think that doesn't help AI's standing in higher ed for sure, but also in larger popular culture, right? Like it's, we need more examples of people using AI for good, not for evil, right? Like we need more examples of it being in conversation with other ways of making, other ways of thinking, not just replacing things we already know. And that, I guess, would be the other point. It's like, when a new technology sort of appears, the first sort of season that it's out is people just trying to kind of retrofit it to do things we already know how to do or already understand. And then as it grows and sort of lives, we start to figure out, oh, what are things that I didn't even imagine that this could do? Smartphones is the obvious example, right? Like the first smartphones didn't do much of anything. And now they're little computers in our pocket. And that took time. It took iteration, right? That like a phone, smartphone started as, well, what are things that other phones do that we can make this do? And I think AI is still in that season. Like,
well, as Ethan Mollick puts it, this is the worst AI you'll ever use.
Yeah. And I think I would add to that, this is the worst ways we're going to use it. Mm-hmm. Because right now, we're not even thinking about what's the actually interesting way we can use it.
And if it stopped improving, we'd have enough power and information for 10 years
yes.
to keep figuring out new ways to use it.
Yeah. And in fact, if I was in that, if I was in those trenches right now, that's what I'd be interested in. I wouldn't be as interested in like, well, how high can we go? I would want to answer the next question, which is what else can we have it do? What else is it capable of within the framework of how it exists now?
All right. So I'm going to make you answer your own question.
Yeah, let's do it.
What do you want to do in your classroom with it? And, you know, either the language models or the image models, what do you, using the models that are out now, what do you want to do with either you designing your courses or with your students?
Yeah, I think right now, and again, in some ways, what I'm doing in my classes is what I just described. It's like, okay, what are spaces I'm already occupying? How can AI enter those conversations? And I think what I want to do next is, well, how can we push its boundaries? Like, can we, you know, what happens if we ask it to make an entire, like, what happens if we ask it to like curate its own art exhibit and like print it all out and do a viewing? Whose is that? What does that mean? Like, those are the questions I want to get into. Yeah. Like, what happens if we ask it to write a full-length play that we then rehearse, memorize, and perform? Whose is it then? Like, and there are avant-garde theater makers and artists who are already asking these questions, but I want in on that, because I think that, to me, that can elucidate what's the next thing it might do that we're not thinking of yet. Because right now, in sort of mainstream culture, it's a lot of, oh, well, let's train it on this actor's voice so we don't have to pay them money to do their work anymore. Right? It's like, it all reads as like lazy and nefarious.
See, Michael's not even sitting here right now. I've made a deep of his voice.
But you know what I mean though, right? It's like, it all reads as like vaguely nefarious. And you're like, well, geez, there's gotta be something else this could do. And I wanna be in a classroom space, in a thinking space, where that feels possible, not where we are kind of generally in this moment, where it's like, golly, like it's all kind of vaguely early 20th century, like mustache twisting villain stuff. You know? And it's like, I know it's capable of more than that. And I know we just haven't imagined how we might use it. I mean, shoot, when they invented the wheel, I'm sure they didn't know exactly what all stuff it was going to get into, right? Yeah. And right now, it feels like it's engendering laziness or corner cutting, not sort of encouraging the next generation of thinkers and doers, right? It's like, again, it's that retrofitting mentality. It's like, how can we have it do things better and faster than people were doing them? Not how can this change the way we think? How can this change the way we do our research? How can that, like, you know, how can this intersect? And I'm sure that this work is happening. Maybe not sure, but I hope that that work is happening. Like, okay, how can the language model intersect with structural engineering research, with cancer research, with, you know, like, how is it in those spaces, not replacing the work that the researchers are doing, but helping them along? Not just how do we get it to, like, pretend that it's somebody who's dead, or how do we get it to do this thing because then I don't have to pay somebody to do it? Because that's when you get into the ethical murky waters, right? Of like, because it, in the image generators, it is pulling from all of the stimuli it's been given. And so what it's making often feels very like, uh-oh, you know. But I also think too that my hope, my aspirational hope, is that down the road, we can think of the sort of act of that prompting, the act of that generation, to be its own kind of art. But until we stop this season of using it as a shortcut and move into a space where it can have its own life and language as an art form or as a method of communicating, it's always going to feel cheap and uninspired.
It's tricky because, like, straight theft, I understand being a problem.
Yes.
But then, like, because I go back and forth a lot and I think about it a lot. And so when you, what you're talking about, like, where it's taking all of these sources and stuff, it's like, well, I've also seen 1,000 movies about the person who comes along and saves everyone. Or,
oh, yeah, messianic storytelling. Yeah. Arrow's dirty. Yeah.
Yeah. Or I see a movie and I'm like, oh, that's definitely, they liked Lord of the Rings when they were writing this. So
in some ways but it just goes back to what we were just talking about, right? That, like, in that example, it feels like inspiration. In this example, it feels like cheating. Yeah. And that's all about orientation.
Yeah.
And how do we orient to how we're using it? How do we orient to how we sort of take ownership of and talk about what we did, right? Because often, because AI in the visual art world is such a dirty word, people don't want to talk about their work in it, or they don't want to talk about it in a public facing way, because often you're subjected to all sorts of scrutiny and criticism, right? So, yeah, I mean, you're right. I said that earlier too, that design is ultimately curation, right? Like, we're gathering disparate things and making something new with them. I think that's what the generative models are doing, in the same way that, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. Everything's already been imagined, you know, all the aphorisms.
Perfect. Exactly what I wanted to just ask you, because there was a recent essay published by one of the leaders of the AI labs talking about how these generative AI models are trained on things humans have created. So these models can't actually produce anything novel. They can only take what you just said, disparate things put together to make something that's just a collection. You are a creative person. You work in a creative environment. Do you think these generative AI tools can create anything novel?
I think it only gains novelty in the context of my relationship to it, right? Like, it's
how you interpret it.
Yes. And it's novel in the context of my own experience looking at things, right? Like, because it's sort of word bank is broader than mine, it will inevitably bring me something that I didn't recognize. But it is ultimately like using generative models is like looking in a mirror, but the mirror is not even all of humanity. I think that's part of the problem, right? Is that, like, that's a huge question that I want to continue exploring. It's like, you know, I don't think we spend enough time asking, like, how are we choosing what gets put into these models? Who is choosing what gets put into these models? What is getting put into these models, right? Like, that, to me, we could spend like 3 hours yapping about that. Like, that feels like,
those are the unintentional but inherent biases built in.
Yes, which is, like, again, is a big part of how I teach AI and ethical AI usage. Is like, I can't speak to all of those, but I think it's important to acknowledge that they're there, right? Mm-hmm. But it's word bank, like, it's like looking into a mirror that is the sum total of all of that stimuli reflected back at you. But, like, it can't create something that's outside of the confines of all of that information. I mean, it's the same, like, but again, it's the reason it makes Monster People, because it doesn't know what a human being is. It simply knows that these are the shapes that stick out of these other shapes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you end up with, like, I love seeing monster people. Because it's like, it's such an easy way to know that you're looking at somebody who again, used it as a shortcut. Mm-hmm. And that's the era I'm ready to get out of. Okay. It's like the era of us using it in the easy way, mm-hmm. as opposed to using it in the interesting way. And so I think that's been my whole journey, is how do I use it in the interesting way? And I've had other designers come up to me and say, like, can you talk to me more about this? Because mm-hmm. what you're doing is really interesting. And that's because I got bored with the easy way. I got bored with the sort of reductive use pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. Because frankly, like, that's not how I don't draw inspiration from that, but I do draw inspiration from using the fact that I know lots of qualifiers, and I know lots of, I spent a lot of time providing verbal context for something that's going to be visual or audio. Like in lighting and sound design, in a costume design, we can look at clothing and say, oh, this resonates with me, or oh, this silhouette resonates with me. And in sound, music maybe, but like how it collages together, maybe not so. In lighting, it's really hard to sort of pin that down. So that's how I kind of found my way to using generative tools in a way that I found interesting, was like, well, how can I use the language I use when I talk to my collaborators, feed it into the program, see what it gives me? Like, how is it interpreting the sort of language I use to describe story? And then what does that unlock in my conversations when I show that on top of saying the thing? It's like, that's what I want people to, like, that's what I want out of AI. It's like, I want us to start moving in that or some entirely unknown direction, rather in the sort of retrofitting, retrograde approach of how can I make it do something that I already do, but do it easier or faster or more efficiently.
Yeah, I'm definitely ready to move out of the clearly AI generated YouTube videos, like,
yes,
that have no soul or heart.
Well, because again, we're just sort of like, and now we're in a sort of self-feeding loop of, that's most of the examples of AI usage we get in mainstream media and mainstream consumption, is like, oh, you know, deepfakes and all of this technology that, like, really feels like it's better served in another way, but like, we haven't been able to break out of, how does it do something I already understand? Not, can it understand something I don't yet? Or can it help me understand something I don't yet? That goes back to the research component, right? It's like, how can it help me find my way to something more interesting, mm-hmm. rather than how can it shortcut something I already understand?
Mm-hmm. You seem like your journey has been a little bit from skeptic to curiosity to practitioner, maybe even bordering on evangelist now.
I would say that's true.
How would you advise some of your colleagues, especially who haven't used it or are skeptical or apprehensive? What would you say to them?
Sure. Honestly, my big piece of advice is play with it. Like, figure out what it says to you. Mm-hmm. Put yourself in conversation and context with it and listen to that. Feel your way through that. Like, you're not going to just open up ChatGPT and suddenly become a believer. Mm-hmm. That was not why. I mean, you said it pretty much right. Like, I have kind of, I'm leaving my apologist era and entering my evangelist era. Like, I really do think that this is a powerful and incredible thing. And I think that I've been fortunate in that my own reputation in collaborative spaces is such that they don't balk when I bring it into the conversation. But I think that, like, there are people who are like, I don't know about the AI thing. And it's like, well, let me tell you about my journey, right? It's like, it ends up feeling a little bit like adjacent missionary work. But the way I started was really meaningful to me, which was use it. Mm-hmm. Figure out what you can make it do. And then figure out, like, what is my relationship to this? If after using it, I'm still like, I'm not so sure about this. Like, live in that uncertainty, continue using it. Don't even use it for high stakes things, right? Like, my first ChatGPT generations were all pretty superficial. It was like, tell me the next season of the Department of Theater and Dance at Wake Forest University. That's how it gave me, like, a. And then I said, well, what about if you made it like a slightly more like slightly more sort of saccharine or surface level season. And it's like, okay, here you go. It's like, oh, what if it was more experimental or avant-garde? And it's like, but it was just so that I could build literacy. And I think some of my colleagues have already been, they're already on that journey. I think if you relegate it to the space of, did I write my student's paper, you're doing yourself a disservice as an educator. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to hold space for, did my student refuse it to write? Like, I think that is essential, because right now that is mostly how students want to use it, is like going back to that shortcut thing, right? But I think we become better stewards for technology and learning if we have our own sort of developed opinion. Or if you're not comfortable like jumping in to use a model, there is a lot of writing on the ethics and boundaries of these things, right? Like, I would like dive into the scholarly writing, because there's all, like when I started, there was not as much. Now there is a ton. So like, if that's your way in, let that be your way in, because there are lots of people who have like kind of full spectrum opinions about it, who write about it. Yeah. They're not just apologists. They're not just haters, right? Yeah. It's like, a lot of people who are writing in the scholarly space have a pretty well-rounded view of what it is and isn't.
What can Wake Forest do to support literacy better or help people get more comfortable?
Well, I love a lot of the things Wake is already doing. Like Betsy has this lovely, I'm on an AI listserv. It's like all of the kind of folks in this kind of vanguard that have been playing with it already. I know the Center for the Advancement of Teaching has already, and information services have already like started trying to build conversations around these tools in a university setting. I mean, I wrote a piece for the Cat blog on the same subject. I'm curious to go back and read it now after I want to listen to this and then go back to what I wrote like a year and a half ago. I remember what I wrote that time though was like, I had a student write in the exam question about like, you know, how do you see AI intersecting with theatrical creativity? I had a student write, I'm actually grateful that I did this, because I just like, I realized AI is kind of dumb. It's like, it is, right? Like it is both more profound than you think it is. And it's also far, far dumber than you think it is, right? Like
exactly what turned me on AI. I was never against it, but once I saw how awesome and then also not awesome it was, I was kind of like, okay,
yeah,
I get it.
Yeah. That it both is the coolest and kind of not coolest thing you'll interact with, really puts it into perspective, right? But I'll be curious to see how my talking around it has changed. But yeah, I think the university is doing a decent job in as far as there are still lots of faculty who I think are not eager to jump on, you know? Mm-hmm. And we don't want to alienate those folks. We don't want to say like, you're being left behind. It's like, no, I don't even think that's true. But I think the more of those folks in the sort of, swing voters, but you know what I mean? They're like the folks who are undecided. Yeah. Like, I want to see the university continue to hold space for helping those folks find their way into it.
I appreciate how honest it is all felt too, from the things I've been a part of here. So that's been really reassuring.
Yeah, because it doesn't feel like, you know. And also, too, Wake Forest has always been at the vanguard of technological improvements anyway. So it only makes sense that we would be interested in these things. And like, again, shout out to Betsy, because she's been doing the Lord's work on this stuff pretty much since I jumped in. Like, and she's on social media. She's in the listserv. I mean, like, and a lot of the folks in CAT are doing a great job of connecting with faculty who are engaged in these questions and helping them. Like for me, it was definitely because it was a journey kind of centered around art making, it felt very solitary at the start and then sort of spread out as I figured it out. I think for others, that may not be the pathway in, right? So I think really the question, what can Wake Forest be doing to sort of better communicate about it, is like, just make it accessible. Access is king, right? Like how can people access it? But also, how can they access tools and conversation? And because like any of those sort of like AI drop-ins or AI salons that have happened, it's like, keep doing that, you know, because I think that, and also keep having these conversations, right? Like I'm sure you've gathered a few folks to have these conversations with, like, you know, what can we do to help you make it better, you know, to make those conversations happen? Like, I think that's also part of it, is like engage, you know, continue engaging the people who are already kind of knee deep in it,
mm-hmm.
so that we can also continue to,
hopefully your story inspires others.
Well, I hope so. But yeah, I mean, I think like AI is exciting. And also, it's a little silly.
It's terrifying.
Yeah, it is. Well, but here's the thing, though. Like, I don't think it's terrifying. And that's because, like, empathy, what is it? Exposure breeds empathy. Empathy breeds understanding, right? Like, knowing a person helps you empathize with their experience, helps you understand it. And that's been my journey with AI. Like, there's a lot I don't understand. But until such a time comes that pathway doesn't work, that exposing myself to the tools doesn't make me connect to them or understand them, I'm not too scared. And also, too, I've been like watching, I don't know, I watched the anime Ghost in the Shell when I was a child. I've been asking these questions pretty much from infancy. And I love, like, I've always been fascinated by that question, like the sort of foundational Blade Runner question of, what is humanity? What is that sort of, what is that unspoken or untouchable or unknowable thing that makes us, us? Yeah. And when is a machine model in conversation with that? Yeah, like,
we haven't even gotten into sentience.
But that doesn't scare me. It's interesting to me. And maybe I should be scared, but like also like I choose not to live in that space because I also think, if I, like, for my friend Will, like, he sort of lives in the gossamer thin line between excitement and terror mm-hmm. when he's working with AI, and that works for him. It doesn't work for me. I want to live in a space of excitement and, yeah, acknowledge that that fear is real and that that anxiety is real, but I don't want to let that hold space in my conversation with it yeah. because I also want to provide a balanced sort of divest as much bias or perspective out of the way I talk about it to my students as I can. So I don't want to live too much in the, like, just wait, 10 minute or two is coming.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, could that be true? Absolutely. But like, I want them to come to that conclusion on their own. Yeah. I don't want my feeling about it to influence that.
I could see a Terminator future the same way that, just as much as I could foresee this just being a glorified Clippy that's everywhere.
Yes.
Honestly.
Yeah, yeah. I think so. And like, to me, I'm happy to just sort of live it. I'm happy in the Clippy era, which yeah. is where we are now, I think. And again, seeing them hit those plateaus has also eased some of my anxiety around it too. Like, sure, that doesn't mean that we're at a forever plateau, but like, we're definitely hitting some walls that felt unhittable 2 years ago.
Yeah.
It felt like, oh my God, like, they're gonna start the Sentinel program from the X-Men here in like 5 years time. That's like, no. Like, it still doesn't know what happened after 2022. You're good. So yeah. I also think too that like I'd rather laugh at or enjoy the absurdity, but also be a really intentional explorer. Than spend too much time in the sort of terror part of it. But also, like, I acknowledge that that's definitely a real space that, like, has grounding to yeah. be in. So,
well, hopefully we can inspire some more intentional explorers.
Yeah. What a good phrase. It's almost as if we hit the end of this conversation.
Well, I mean, we could, like you said, talk for 3 more hours.
Yeah.
But I think that is a perfect place to end on.
Yeah. I encourage anyone listening, become an intentional explorer. It's the way to find your way through just about anything, but it's also how I find my way through AI.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Deeks.ai podcast, where Wake Forest innovators unpack the real-world magic of artificial intelligence through candid conversations. We hope you'll continue to join us as we explore how AI is transforming work across campus, one fascinating story at a time.